This is the Creating Wealth Through Self-Storage show by Mark Helm. Nothing Mark shares with you guarantees your success in the self-storage business. This is for informational purposes only. There are no calls to action, and nothing said or implied is a call for investment money into self-storage or any other asset class. You are responsible for your success in the self-storage business or any endeavor in life. Enjoy the show, and here is Mark Helm.
So as I approach episode 500, 10 years or so of making these videos and these blogs, I was thinking, what could I share that might be most impactful? And I came to two realizations. One was, it's not the stuff I've done right. It's the thing that would make the most impact and help for you would be the things I've done wrong, the mistakes I've made. And so as I started listing the five mistakes, the biggest mistakes I think I've made in my career in self-storage, what I realized was not many of them were, or any of them really, were around wrong decisions in self-storage necessarily. There were more flaws with me and my leadership and my character at the time. So let me share with you what I think are the five biggest mistakes I've made in the self-storage business since over the last 31 years of my being in and around the industry. My name is Mark Helm. I'm the author of Creating Wealth Through Self-Storage, and I'm the creator of the Quick Start Academy, which houses the training like this that I offer, as well as the paid courses I offer. And I'm here to support the small investor who wants to get in the self-storage business or grow their self-storage business. You can find out more about it at creatingwealththroughselfstorage.com. But let me share with you what I think, anyway, are the five biggest mistakes I've made in my self-storage career. So mistake number one we could call leadership, partnership selection, and management. Now let me be clear here. I'm very grateful for all the partners I've had over the years, and I've had a lot, and I'm very grateful for them. But I realize often we tend, either consciously or unconsciously, to select partners that basically make up and bring something to the table, make up for our weaknesses and bring something to the table we don't necessarily have. And that's usually a good thing, but not always. You know, one of my weaknesses is my tendency to avoid conflict. So one of the things I have in my world often are partners, including my spouse, who are fairly strong-willed people and are not afraid of having tough conversations. Now, this weakness probably comes from my family of origin, and it's something I've had to deal with and overcome, or at least overcome to some degree. So there were times in my first 15, 20 years in the self-storage business and managing partners, I was usually the sponsor, the lead guy in all the projects, where it was appropriate to address some decisions that other partners made. And I had a tendency to avoid it or not to do it effectively. Now, as the organizer, as the manager of the LLCs, that was usually my job, and I didn't do it very well. And what would happen is issues would build up, problems would arise, and then finally I'd have to deal with it. Whereas if I had had the right conversations at the right time, there wouldn't be problems, or they would have been addressed earlier. I don't want to go into a lot of specifics, but here's an example. Often, partners would hire employees that I was pretty sure were not up to the task. But rather than, you know, create conflict and address it head on at the time, I would give them the benefit of a doubt, even though I knew they weren't the right people, and I would wait till something happened. Then I would insist, once a problem had arisen, that we let that particular employee go. Now, I don't think it's appropriate to like go into a lot of detail with some of the other stuff, but that was a real weakness of mine. We would have achieved our vision on the size of our portfolio much quicker had I been a better leader earlier in my career. It's still something that's a work in progress for me. Mistake number two, not following my own advice. You know, I give a lot of advice to people I coach, train, these episodes. And one of the things I tell people is you never get emotionally tied up in a deal. You run your preliminary performance, then you go through the due diligence. And if during the due diligence, your benchmark numbers aren't hit, you're not emotionally tied to the deal and you can walk. Now, I've had one deal that really went south and didn't go as we planned. Not every deal I've done has hit our performance numbers, but most have. Most have exceeded. And every deal's been profit, with the exception of this one for some of the partners. I got really excited about this deal because it was presented to me by the landowner who had developed a small little business park, and at the end of a cul-de-sac, right next to an expressway, but at the end of a cul-de-sac was a tract of land that he was willing to put in a self-storage deal because he thought self-storage would go there. And I got real excited because I didn't have to buy the land. It was being contributed to the partnership. And I didn't necessarily do the best due diligence because all the properties around us had these huge signs that were on a north-south expressway, but the sign ordinance had changed. And I'd owned property next to expressways, and I knew how the benefit of that exposure and what it was. And I knew people would make one or two turns off an exit, you know, less than a mile, which is what this facility was, to get to the facility. Householding, when I got into due diligence, this was before we had all of the subscription services that we have now. Household income was lower than the median for the city it was in, but I didn't have to buy the land. So I would totally advise someone not to think that way. But I sure didn't follow my own advice. Anyway, long story short, we did the development, built the deal. Of course, lease up went a lot slower than we wanted because the median household income was lower. Average stay was shorter, so we ended up leasing the same units multiple times on our way to stabilized occupancy. And I realized that I needed to pivot because my interest-only period was coming to an end. And we certainly weren't profitable at that point. It was going to be really bad once the amortization kicked in. So I got the partners together. The one thing that was working there was the parking. So I said, let's pivot. I'm going to have a cash call. We're going to create more parking. It'll be a lot less than finishing this project, and it will generate the income needed quickly to take, you know, to pay the loan when it starts amortizing. Some of my investors didn't want to do the cash call. They were gun shy and scared. So basically I broke off a piece of that land free and clear, gave it to them. They wanted to own that rather than do the cash call and stay in the deal. So I ended up making the pivot. We refinanced the deal, did the pivot, ended up selling that project, making it be a must take for a really good project that we were selling to a fund. And we ended up making a profit, albeit not what I had on my pro forma and not with the asset that we originally designed. I hope my investors were able to sell the land and get their money back. Now, everyone tells me not to worry about it because they chose it. But hindsight's always 2020, isn't it? Mistake number three, not following the LLC document to the letter. This also ties into the first mistake, not being a good leader. But I had some partners that basically made a decision. The decision was for the benefit of the company, the LLC, the partnership that the investors were in. But the LLC document spelled out very clearly what the sponsors were going to get as compensation. The sponsors and the sponsors' families were going to get as compensation, and we weren't to get anything else. Percentage of the cash flow, management, fees, etc. Well, as a vendor that we were using started getting more and more expensive, my operations manager and partner decided to hire her husband at a cheaper rate to the company and to the investors to do the same work. I wasn't like 100% clear that that was a violation of the LLC agreement. But one of our investors was pretty dang sure it was a violation of the LLC agreement, called me on the carpet for it. And investor trust is critical, especially when it comes time to inform them of issues that we need to deal with. Without that trust, it can become a difficult or more difficult conversation. So it took me a while to begin to rebuild that trust with that investor who talked to other investors. And it was all because I didn't know everything in the LLC agreement. Know your LLC agreements inside and out, particularly if you have passive investors. Know what your roles and responsibilities are, where your income can come from, and if you want to deviate from it, can you do so with permission, without permission, with a vote? Know your LLC agreement. I never made that mistake again. Mistake number four, giving investors too much power. So, especially earlier in my career, I wanted to make investor-friendly organizations where investors felt safe, secure, and empowered. And in one LLC, one group, we ended up raising enough money to buy like three deals. We didn't have those deals picked out, but the LLC agreement defined what those deals were going to be, what the parameters were, and we raised, you know, more. It wasn't just a single deal, almost like a blind fund. Well, the investors wanted to have a board to initially approve the deals were that were coming into that LLC. I create investor-friendly LLC, so of course, let's do that. Well, that board quickly morphed into much more than that. It was more like an oversight board. They were making suggestions on vendors we should use. They were making suggestions on who I should hire as a CFO. And they came up with requests for all kinds of reports and financial modeling. And I spent so much time creating reports, responding to the board's requests, and it took so much of my time, energy, and resources away from actually doing profitable things for the self-storage growth and that LLC in particular, that it ended up just really gumming everything up. And I realized, and my attorney told me, and my partners, other sponsor partners told me, I had given them just way too much power. So I learned that lesson the hard way. And mistake number five is not having a predetermined, powerful exit plan for when I sell property. Now, not every property in every LLC I've been in do I have the capability of doing a 1031 or and just simply because of how some of those LLCs were formed, but many of them we do. I do. Like, I can take my sale proceeds and invest it in other real estate, in other storage facilities if I want to. But sometimes we do goofy things to avoid capital gains. I'd had a year where we were selling a lot of self-storage, you know, closing out a particular portfolio, primarily to a REIT, and I had paid a boatload of capital gains that year. And we had one final deal coming in December, and I was tired of paying capital gains on it. So a large developer in my marketplace was talking about doing a self-storage project in another city, and it was in, it happened to be in an opportunity zone. And we closed the deal in mid-December, and if I put that money in that opportunity zone before the end of the year, I was going to get another 10% reduction in my tax basis. So I did it. The numbers were a little bit tight on the pro forma, but, you know, I was saving a lot of money. Well, that was, I think, 2021, and interest rates started going up. Construction costs started going up. A lot of product hit the market in that particular city or trade area of that city, and the rental rates were going down. So all of a sudden, it was an okay deal, but worth doing because I was avoiding taxes, became a deal I would never do. So long story short, that land is still sitting there right now. So I have hundreds of thousands of dollars tied up in an opportunity zone, generating no income. I would have been infinitely better off paying the capital gains and putting the rest of that money to work, or doing something different with that money than doing what I did to not pay taxes and get a 10% reduction in my tax base. Weak planning on my part. So there's a real art to buying storage, and there's a real art and skill to selling it, to maximize what you've created and to put that money to work, generating more income and wealth. So as I look back over my career, those tended to be what I saw as the five biggest mistakes I've made. Interestingly enough, very few of them had to do with making storage decisions. They were all challenges that I created for myself. I've taught and learned that if you want to expand your business, the very first thing we do is expand ourselves first and then take on growing the business. So I'm constantly working on creating a bigger, better version of myself, so that I have more to contribute to my business, to my partners, to my customers, to my wife, and to life itself. Shameless plug here, the book I wrote, The Creative Method of Wealth Generation, deals very directly with this. If you're interested, there's a link in the text, and there's a link in the body of the YouTube video that will explain more about that book. So I hope this helps you as you're growing your self-storage business, and I look forward to being with you in the next episode, which is episode 500. I'll see you then.